Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Pensions Expert Podcast. This week we'll be discussing the pensions regulator's views on the defined benefit market. I'm Maria Espadinha, Deputy Editor at Pensions Expert, and joining me is David Fares, Executive Director of Regulatory Policy Analysis and Advice at TPR. We will discuss the recent criticisms made to the regulator's DB funding code, how TPR sees COVID-19 and its impact on pension schemes, and what we can expect in the consolidator space now that an interim regime has been launched. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us. I would start by asking you about the DB funding code consultation, which was launched in March, around the same time that we had COVID-19 and lockdown. The consultation is closing soon, but there has been some voices pointing out some concerns on how the two systems, Fast Track and Bespoke, are going to work in parallel. How is the regulator seeing these kind of concerns?
Yeah, we launched the consultation on the funding code back in March, and we thought we were introducing it into a period of economic and political stability. And then, of course, we had COVID-19. We recognised actually that the initial consultation period perhaps didn't give people enough time to think about the issues that we were raising in the consultation. So we extended the closing date for consultation out to the 2nd of September. I think it's really important to stress that this consultation, we're envisaging that there may be two consultations, but this first consultation is very much around the principles that we are looking to use in terms of developing the new funding code. When COVID happened, we looked very carefully at the issues that we were raising in our consultation document to see whether any of the principles needed to change. And actually, we think that those principles are still the right principles and still very pertinent. Some issues that we raise within the consultation document around visibility of horizon of covenant and sustainable investment risk. Because of COVID, we think actually are more pertinent and more relevant to focus on than perhaps we'd ever imagined when we originally wrote the consultation document. And as you rightly say, Maria, the consultation document sets out two alternative ways of meeting funding requirements. The first of those is a more well-defined path, more structured, more parameterized path under Fast Track. And then the second is where the existing flexibility in the system is maintained under Bespoke. And really, we developed those two alternative ways because when I first joined the pensions regulator and we talked to advisors and trustees about what they wanted to see in the code, roughly around half of those sat around the table said, we don't want all this flexibility that exists in the system. We just want to be told how to work out our technical provisions, to work out what our deficit is, and then we just want you to tell us how much we've got to pay and for how long. We don't have the resources and can't afford to spend lots of money getting advice on which route is best. So roughly half the people said, actually, we just want a more defined, more structured way of meeting the funding requirements. And the other half, and it probably was the larger pension scheme, said actually they really value the flexibility that's in the existing system. So really, the rationale for going down those two routes is to try and meet those two competing demands. For those that want a more structured approach, then we have Fast Track. For those that value flexibility in the system, there's Bespoke. So we are consulting around the terms of Fast Track and how it's structured. Because of COVID, we are going to have to rethink some of the parameters that we set out originally in the original funding consultation, where we tried to illustrate how Fast Track might work. So some of that detail will probably change by the time we get to the second consultation. But Fast Track is there. We had particularly in mind that Fast Track might appeal to smaller schemes, and therefore whenever we structured an item within Fast Track, we looked at how small schemes would be able to meet those requirements. So we've got a more parameterized way of doing things under Fast Track, more flexibility under Bespoke. And I think some of the criticism that you're saying is actually people are a little bit worried that actually Bespoke is just a variation of Fast Track.
Yes.
And I think some of that actually stems from the fact that we said that when we're looking at actuarial valuations submitted under the bespoke route, we'll measure that relative to fast track. Clearly, when we're looking at prudence, you know, the question always is, well, prudent relative to what? And because what we're setting out under fast track is a journey plan that for us has a level of tolerated risk within it. We're not saying it doesn't have any risk. It's a journey plan with tolerated level of risk. Then that's an appropriate measure by which we can judge actuarial valuations under bespoke. But we're not going to apply that rigidly or unintelligently. So it might well be that we see valuations that are under the bespoke approach, and they're actually quite close to where we would want them to be if they were going down the fast track route. But they may not then meet our requirements because, for example, they're not putting much money into the pension scheme, but they're paying a lot of money to shareholders. And contrary, you know, schemes are a long way away from fast track, might still meet our requirements because actually for affordability reasons, the scheme has got a really long recovery plan just because that's all it can afford. So it might appear a long way from the parameters that we set out in fast track, but it might still satisfy the funding requirements. So we're saying we're just using that as a measure. We're not being unintelligent around how we use that. We'll just use that to measure how much risk is being taken, and then we'll engage with schemes under the bespoke route, looking at the particular characteristics under those schemes. So, you know, we are trying to preserve flexibility under bespoke. It's probably fair to say that those schemes that push the boundaries, you know, they set very optimistic assumptions, and so they had long, low technical provisions. They had really long recovery periods. Maybe they back-end loaded their recovery plan. Actually, you know, there may be more constraint for those type of schemes than perhaps there has been previously. But we think that's right. People who are pushing the boundaries, abusing the system, we think it's right that they may be more constrained.
And two things. One thing that you mentioned is that you think that you'll need to make some changes to the fast track approach because of COVID. Can you explain a little bit more how COVID is going to make, how is going to impact on fast track, and what kind of changes can people expect?
Yeah, as I said, you know, we think the principles that we've set out in this first consultation are still the right principles, but clearly we're looking for feedback on whether that is the case. But within the first consultation, we set out some illustrative examples of what discount rates might look like. Clearly, because of COVID, we're in a very different circumstance. It may well be that interest rates are low for quite a long period of time. It may be that asset returns are very different to the ones that we were anticipating back in March. So when we define the real detail of the parameters under fast track, we will have to take account of current economic circumstances and some of the uncertainty. Clearly, it wouldn't help the industry, it wouldn't help us, if we set the parameters for fast track such that, you know, very few schemes could actually go down that route. Part of the rationale of fast track is to provide a well-defined route for schemes to go down. And that benefits us as a regulator because we know those schemes are on a journey. As I say, it's got a tolerated level of risk within it. So actually, we don't need to intervene or scrutinise those actuarial valuations to the same degree as we would for valuation under the bespoke route. So clearly, the more schemes that go down the fast track route, that's helpful in terms of us diverting and prioritising our resources in looking at actuarial valuations. So we will need to adjust the fast track term so that enough schemes can actually meet the requirements of fast track. And we're doing that analysis at the moment to understand actually what parameters need to change, how much they need to change by.
And on this topic, one last question, which is, there's been some concerns as well that employers, which are currently having a good deficit recovery plan in place, if they go through the fast track, they might be able to level down from stronger funding plans. Is this something that you are aware of, or that you are considering for when the scheme makes an application for a fast track option, for example?
Yeah, this is something that we thought about really quite carefully when we were developing the funding code. because we're saying that fast track is a it's a journey plan with a tolerated level of risk, and we're saying if schemes follow that, then we're not going to intervene or put them under close scrutiny. And clearly there will be some schemes that will easily satisfy the terms of fast track. So we thought, actually, if they're ahead of the journey that we require on fast track, should we kind of force them to maintain that, be ahead of the game, or would we allow them to reduce? And it seemed logical to us that just because by accident of a previous agreement, if they happen to be ahead of fast track, we shouldn't basically compel them to do that. So those schemes could, if they chose, drop down to fast track, if you like, they could ease up on contributions to the pension scheme. Now, clearly for us as a regulator, if people are ahead of where they need to be in fast track, we want to encourage them to keep going. We actually think it makes sense from the scheme's point of view not to actually take the foot too far off the accelerator, because actually, if you're well ahead of fast track, then actually that gives you a cushion so that you know in future years, if there's some adverse experience, you haven't suddenly got to increase your contribution. So actually, we think being slightly ahead of the bare minimum of where you need to be to comply with fast track actually potentially is a good place for the trustees to be. It's a good place for the employer to be, because they potentially then have a more stable contribution rate if they hit some bumps in the road along the journey. So we'd strongly encourage people, if they are ahead of where they need to be in fast track, to keep going. But, you know, recognizing that there could be some bumps in the road, people could take their foot off the accelerator if they need to.
We've already discussed COVID-19. We saw several measures being implemented by the regulator around the same time lockdown was imposed and when the economy started suffering. What is the current scenario for schemes? Have they been able to cope with the impacts from the pandemic, do you think?
Yeah, as you said, Maria, we introduced a number of easements over 2019 valuations, where actually at the beginning of the breakout of COVID, they may be coming up against their 15-month deadline. We allowed schemes an extra 3 months to complete their valuations. We said to them, don't undo all the assumption setting that you've previously done, but just to have a look to see whether contributions are still affordable, and we gave them an extra 3 months to do that. For actuarial valuations that are due this year, we recognise that there are some really difficult challenges in terms of setting assumptions. And we asked trustees to work with employers and encourage employers to share information with trustees around how they feel that their business will emerge from this economic crisis, this lockdown, the speed at which they might return to normal, and look at a range of scenarios. So we're asking employers to share those scenarios with trustees, and for trustees and employers to work together on a funding approach, which actually is both fair to the trustees and pension scheme members, but also to the extent that there needs to be some flexibility, that there is some flexibility for the employer. So we recognise that setting and agreeing actuarial valuations as at March, April this year is going to be particularly challenging. And we have said, if we think it's appropriate, we may issue some further guidance around that. But as you rightly say, there are some employers that got much more immediate financial pressures. And the easements that we gave was that trustees could agree to a request from the employers to stop contributions or defer contributions in the short term. Actually, what we have seen is that already some of those, that deferral or stopping of contributions have already been made good. So actually employers have been helped through those difficult challenges. But within the regulator, we are seeing a number of requests now for different recovery plans, perhaps slightly extended, or restructuring of contributions that are coming through, and we're looking at some of those. Many of those have taken the advice on board that we set out for how trustees should react. Some we're actually looking at a little bit more closely, but it's probably fair to say we've not had a huge number of requests to date, around 100 recovery plan amendments to date. So probably quite a modest level of companies and trustees agreeing different recovery plans. Clearly, that's something that we'll monitor and we'll adjust our guidance if we think it's appropriate, depending on how we emerge from this crisis.
But do you think that we will still be talking about COVID-19 for a couple months, or maybe some more time? And is it a long-lasting impact?
The challenge is, I don't think any of us actually know how this is going to happen. I mean, I think what we are seeing is actually, you know, some companies and some pension schemes are coming through this crisis in pretty good shape. Employers have maintained cash flow and profitability, and actually they're been almost insulated from some of the impacts. Some have been hit very hard, but actually have recovered relatively quickly. Maybe they're doing more business remotely or online, and they've recovered quite quickly. But there are clearly some businesses where this has a long-lasting impact. And clearly there'll be some companies that might have to go through quite severe restructurings or may become insolvent. So I think, you know, the way that we come through this crisis will be very different for different pension schemes, different employers. And that's actually quite a challenge for us as a regulator, setting guidance for employers and trustees, because each scheme and each employer are probably in a very different place. Somebody rather described it as we're all in the same storm, but we're in different boats and experiencing different things within that storm.
Our last topic is about the consolidated interim regime, which was launched a couple months ago. I know we had, not to speak about it again, but we had COVID-19, which might have moved attention somewhere else. Can you give us a little bit of an update on how that is going? I imagine conversations going on with consolidators. How has been the interim regime has been received?
In terms of super funds, we've always said that we could see some benefits that super funds could bring. They could bring scale, they could bring better governance, access to a wider range of investments and improved investment advice. And some of those things actually DB Master Trust equally bring to the table. But we've said that there are some advantages. We could see some advantage of super funds, but also that we recognise that there are some challenges from super funds that they present, and therefore we need to look at them differently to more normal, regular, defined benefit pension schemes. We've been very clear that in an ideal world, we'd like to see an authorisation regime and appropriate powers for us as a regulator to deal with these new structures. Absent that, we are in the position that we have been engaging with entrants who want to come into the market and operate super funds. And we thought it really important that we set out very clear guidance of what we expect of super funds that are coming into the market. And we're currently in the process of assessing super funds against the criteria that we set out in our interim guidance. And we're not at the end of that assessment process, so we're still in that. We don't have a defined date of when we'll complete our assessments. We'll get there once the super funds that we're assessing have met all our requirements to our satisfaction. And we've been very clear that we see this as a two-stage process. The first is that initial assessment of the super fund itself. The second then is if a scheme wants to transact with the super fund, we'd expect them to come to us for clearance, and that will be the second stage. But what we have seen in the marketplace are some new and innovative financial structures that are beginning to be put in place by trustees. And we thought, whilst we've had really good and strong engagement from super funds coming to want to operate in the market, we thought it was appropriate that our guidance should also extend some of those innovative financial structures. Where the link to the sponsoring employer is maintained, then actually our guidance doesn't apply. But at the point that there was these structures are put in place and there's an insolvency of the sponsoring employer, then we're saying actually these begin to look economically and in substance very much like super funds. And at that stage, we would expect those structures to meet the capital requirements that we've set out in our interim guidance, but also to be cognizant of the triggers that we put in there. So we think it's really important that trustees who are entering into these innovative structures need to understand that when our guidance might apply, what the impact of that guidance might be, so that actually they go into it knowing full well what the ramifications are. And it's probably fair to say that the private equity houses that are standing up capital for these structures, equally they need to understand how that guidance is going to apply, and when actually they may lose if the money that they've put up and invested in these structures. So we wanted to make that clear to the marketplace that if people are doing innovative things, and as a regulator we are open to innovation, but you know, at the heart, because we're a regulator, we've got member interests, saver interests, as our key focus, and we want to make sure that that members' best interests are protected within these structures. So that's where we are. We're not quite at the stage of actually having a super fund that is operating in a business, but we're going through the assessment process, and once we're through that, then we'll be open to transactions taking place.
And have you published this guidance? It's going to be published soon?
That's contained in our interim guidance already. Okay. So that's already published. We are looking to expand and clarify our guidance to trustees who are looking to come into super funds. We're developing that over the coming weeks. So for trustees of pension schemes and employers who are thinking about entering into a transaction with a super fund, we're going to expand and clarify the guidance that we've already put out.
Well, that's all for today. So at the end of the podcast, we have this section which we call Always a Pensions Angle. David, you brought us today a story, so I'll pass it to you.
Yeah, one of my great passions is collecting and investing in wine. And I was trying to think of a parallel between investing in wine and pension scheme. And I was thinking that there's a wine that I have a few cases of called La Muse, and it's produced by the Verity Estate in Sonoma County, California. And it's not ready to drink for 30 years. So I was kind of thinking of the parallel of investing your money in a pension scheme, it being there for, and then you get to enjoy it at a particular point in time. And that may have a parallel to some of the investment. And then I was thinking actually about the oldest bottle actually it's a bottle of port rather than wine that I have, which dates from 1863. And you'll know full well, Maria, that the Pensions Act of 14th of July, 1862, and the Pensions Act of 4th of July, 1864, introduced pensions for those who fought in the US Civil War. So my oldest bottle of 1863 sits neatly between those two pension acts. So I think they're probably one of the earliest bits of legislation around pensions. So that was kind of my kind of always comes back to pensions.
Exactly. And I imagine that when you are finally enjoying your pension, you also have your wine to enjoy that has been, you can only drink in 30 years time.
Yeah, I hope I'm still here and still with it enough to know whether the money that I paid for it was well worth it.
All right. Thank you very much, David, for participating in our podcast.
Thank you, Maria.
And we'll see you again next week.